Hello, this is Jane, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 20 issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And I'll start on the front page with the big headline here, which reads, Ottawa faces test in defending trade deal. Provinces asked to drop liquor bans as U.S. agrees to lower tariffs. And there's a very big picture here of Canada-U.S. Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc as he arrives at the PMO on Wednesday after returning from talks in Washington. And this article is by Tonda McCharles and Stephanie Taylor. Ottawa. Prime Minister Mark Carney faces a tough political challenge to explain to Canadians why a deal that retains lower but punishing tariffs on steel, aluminum, and autos, and would put American booze back on Canadian shelves, was the best trade deal he could reach with U.S. President Donald Trump. Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston, speaking in Banff, Alberta, said the Prime Minister explicitly asked premiers to lift bans on U.S. liquor sales in provincial stores and allow American companies to bid on provincial contracts. Most provinces imposed those retaliatory measures in 2025 after the president blamed Canada for lax borders and unfair trade practices, and slapped 50% tariffs on Canadian and global imports of steel and aluminum, 25% on autos, and additional tariffs on lumber, copper, pharmaceuticals, and a wider range of products. Houston said the latest deal appears to be the best outcome that could have been reached. Carney's top negotiators have accepted Trump's terms, which a federal official acknowledged will not require those sectoral tariffs, known as Section 232 tariffs, to fall to zero, despite Carney's earlier statement that Canada sought their elimination because he viewed them as a violation of the Canada, United States, and Mexico Free Trade Agreement. That's a CUSMA. The New Deal is expected, however, to stave off additional tariffs of 50% on other goods that Trump imposed, invoking a different section of American trade law last month. If the deal falls through, those tariffs will take effect on Saturday after midnight. Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal, citing American sources, reported the proposed deal would lower Trump's 50% sectoral tariff on steel and aluminum to 25%, with the journal additionally reporting that the auto's tariffs would be lowered from 25% to 15%. Canadian officials refused to confirm those numbers to the Star, saying the Prime Minister will disclose details after the legal text is finalized. Canadian officials refused, but Canadian negotiators floated such numbers last weekend to industry leaders. Flavio Volpe, head of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association and a member of the government's advisory committee on Canada-U.S. economic relations, had not yet been briefed on the deal's details. But he said in an interview that an auto tariff reduction from 25% to 15% would still be a blow without the same tariff-free treatment for Canadian origin content that Washington wants for U.S.-made content. Only with that exemption would the Canadian industry face an effective tariff rate of about 7.5% on an average $50,000 car, still above last year's average profit margin of 6% on Canadian-produced vehicles. Volpe said that Ottawa would have to provide further financial supports to keep car making viable in Canada, for example, by reducing corporate income taxes or introducing accelerated capital cost allowances to manufacturers, as was the case after the 2008-09 financial crisis. You can do things with industrial and tax policy to reduce that burden that you don't have to count on the White House for, said Volpe. You just have to be more domestically aggressive in how you nurture and cultivate manufacturing opportunities. But that means the work has just begun for the federal government. Lisa Raitt, a banking executive and former conservative cabinet minister who also sits on Carney's Canada-U.S. Advisory Committee, said the prime minister faces a major political test to explain his strategy to Canadians and to convince them that the concessions he agreed to are worth it. This is a very important moment for him because they admit they've kept the Canadian public in the dark, but they needed to do it for the purposes of negotiation. Canadians accept that, but when you come to the point of explaining everything you are doing, you've got to do what's right. And I think it's in his hands to see how this goes. Is he the hero or is he going to be the zero? Just 8 weeks ago, the Prime Minister stood firm, saying, "I could have signed a bad deal a year ago. We're not going to sign a bad deal, so it has to be a real deal." Now Carney is asking provinces to make specific concessions, accepting reduced sectoral tariffs in exchange for Trump agreeing not to proceed with his latest round of threatened tariffs, and arguing that the proposed agreement nonetheless leaves Canada in a stronger position than other U.S. trading partners. It's unclear if he agreed to roll back other policies the U.S. identified as irritants, such as digital regulations. A senior Liberal official with knowledge of the talks told the Star that Canadian negotiators had to be pragmatic and said Ottawa is on track to enter more formal talks to renegotiate the broader trading relationship under CUSMA. However, the source declined to say whether a date has been set for a formal round of CUSMA review talks like those Mexico is conducting with Washington. Asked if Carney has now normalized Trump's imposition of sectoral tariffs in violation of CUSMA, the official said it was an acknowledgement of reality. It was always very clear that the United States was never going to completely relent on their tariff policy, said the official, who the Star agreed not to identify because they were not authorized to publicly discuss details. You look at any country around the world, there's no country that has zero tariffs. The official acknowledged it is frustrating for people to try to draw conclusions in the absence of more detail. It was about being able to achieve what was within the realm of the possible, and we pushed as hard as we could, the insider said, adding, when Carney lays out the specific details, people will be able to make a fuller evaluation of what's in front of them and whether or not, in their view, that constitutes a good deal. American leaks and political spin framed it as a big win for Trump. Carney posted on X that we are now moving towards an agreement that reinforces that Canadian advantage, including by securing the best terms in each of Canada's most important strategic sectors and providing greater certainty about our future trading relationship. Another Canadian source with knowledge of the recent discussions said the Americans refused to discuss lumber, a critical industry in British Columbia and Quebec, in the latest talks, while the federal official disagreed with that characterization, yet refused to say where softwood lumber tariffs stand. Trump trade ambassador Jameson Greer claimed Canada made significant concessions and would drop trade irritants that Washington had cited in his latest tariff threat. Dairy protections, U.S. alcohol bans in provincial liquor stores, and counter tariffs against American auto parts. Greer claimed the U.S. gained comprehensive market access for all American goods, economic security commitments, and digital trade alignment, among other important provisions. Carney had previously dropped Canada's digital services tax and eliminated requirements for big video streaming platforms to contribute funds to support Canadian content creation, identified as major American concerns. Trump, who on Tuesday night touted the revival of an expanded Keystone XL oil pipeline project as part of the deal, took a couple of victory laps in Washington, telling reporters he granted a three-day pause at Canada's request while details of the proposed deal are nailed down. Canadian officials would not discuss the Keystone project nor any other aspect of the deal. The next article is under the byline of immigration, and the title reads, Canada gave him safe haven. Now it's trying to deport him. Appeal court asked to decide landmark case on ex-refugees. And this is by Nicholas Keong. Roman Slepsik says he is forever grateful to Canada, even though Ottawa is showing him the door after nearly three decades in the country. The former refugee is thankful he could make a living and provide for his family so his two daughters and now two grandchildren could have a good future that they wouldn't have had in the Czech Republic. Canada gave me the opportunity to live my dreams, said the Toronto man, now 58, whose story could end up having far-reaching consequences for Canadian law and for people granted asylum who are caught traveling home, even if he may not be in the country by the time it's resolved. Slepsik fled rising violence against Roma minorities by skinheads in the Czech Republic and came to Canada for asylum in 1997. He was granted protected person status a year later by the Refugee Board and became a permanent resident in 1999. Since then, he's built a life as a tradesman, brought over his daughters, and made a living for himself. He's a Mercedes-Benz aficionado who has owned four of the luxury cars through the years in Canada, albeit all used ones. Here, if I work hard, I can make it. Canada is a land of opportunity. It's the best country in the world. The problem started in 2020. That's when he went home to take care of his brother, who was fighting inoperable bladder cancer. Upon his return to Canada, he was flagged by a border agent because he had voluntarily re-availed himself of the protection of the Czech Republic. It was the last of seven trips he had made to his home country to care for his ill sibling, attend family funerals, and once to help his then wife and two daughters move to Canada. Under a law passed in 2012 by the then conservative government, an ex-refugee's permanent residency depends on them keeping protected person status long after their arrival. Slepsik had his status stripped, in essence, because the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada concluded his travel back and forth to the Czech Republic on his Czech passport suggested he no longer needed the protections Canada gave him in the 1990s. As a result, he automatically lost his permanent residence and has also been barred from applying to stay on a temporary basis, regain his status on humanitarian grounds, and undergo a risk assessment to determine if the Czech Republic is safe for him. Last November, the federal court dismissed Slepsik's constitutional challenge of the Harper-era law. However, it agreed the case involved a serious legal issue of general importance opening the door for a potential landmark appeal. If the Federal Appeal Court agrees that the automatic loss of permanent residence indeed violates his charter rights as a formerly recognized refugee, it could overturn the existing law and could change the fate of dozens of other people also at risk of losing their permanent residency for the same reasons. The appeal hearing has yet to be scheduled, but will likely happen next year. In the meantime, the appeal court last week dismissed Slepcik's plea to pause his imminent removal, giving the green light for the border agency to deport him. What they're doing is breaching a human right before the court had the chance to determine the remedy, his co-counsel Barbara Jackman said in an interview. Who's it going to inconvenience if he stays here while his case is argued? As he scrambled to clear up his cramped apartment in Toronto's Beach neighborhood, Slepcik said the flashbacks of his time in Canada came washing over him like a movie. He still remembered landing in Montreal with his younger brother, Frederick, and making the refugee claim at the airport in September 1997, before traveling to Toronto, where they stayed initially in a homeless shelter. A few months later, they were thrilled to move into their own apartment and started working as cleaners. The boss could not afford to hire two people, so he took us both in with one pay, recalled Slepcik. We split the $8 an hour. Freddie got $4 and I got $4. In 1998, the brothers met a home builder who hired them as carpenters. He would ultimately spend 24 years working for the same builder until his body gave out from wear and tear. He still struggles with severe back pain, which he believes is in part related to the stress from his immigration limbo. Slepcik said he used to work 10 hours a day, Monday through Saturday, and only got to spend Sunday with his two daughters, who joined him in 2001. He said he never took vacation except once for a three-day trip to take his girls to an amusement park in Buffalo. He provided everything for us, said his elder daughter, Jana, now 37, who works in the hospitality industry. He's a very good dad. He has given me and my sister a future. We went to school. We have the opportunity to make a living for ourselves. We are comfortable where we are. I'm sure if we were back in Czech Republic, it would be a different story. She added, where's he going to live? He doesn't even know how anything works there. Slepcik laughed when he recalled teaching Jana how to drive in a school parking lot and how she backed up into a concrete post and wrecked his bumpers, and seeing how her eyes lit up when he handed her the keys to a used Volkswagen Beetle that she always wanted. Frederick said family always comes first for his older brother. When his son was born in 2015 and brought home from the hospital, Slepcik was standing in the hallway with a crib because he was thrilled to welcome the baby boy to the family. Roman is always there, said Frederick. He's not a criminal. He traveled home to help others in his family. He deserves to stay. He's a law-abiding citizen. He paid taxes, he never cheated, he did not commit any crime. In dismissing Slepcik's request to suspend his removal, Justice Vanessa Rochester said the Federal Appeal Court recognized that removal from Canada is immensely stressful, anxiety-provoking, deeply sad, and heartbreaking. A deportee loses their job and abandons their studies, while all health and social benefits cease, she wrote. It also entails enforced separation from loved ones and friends, along with being torn from the stability and comfort one may have known here. Nevertheless, she added, these are the inherent consequences of being removed from Canada. Our role is not to alleviate sadness, tragedy, and difficult circumstances, the judge wrote in her reasons, nor is our role to stand in the way of a federal agency exercising its statutory duty or to unduly interfere with the normal administrative process prescribed by Parliament. Slep Six said he's having a tough time packing up as he laid out his belongings on the floor, as each brings special memories to him. There were the stacks of family photos, presents his daughters got him for Christmas, all the birthday cards the girls gave him, and a winter coat that Frederick bought him from the Goodwill store for his first winter in Canada. I've got 15 boxes, and that's not even fully packed yet, said Slepsik, whose close family members in the Czech Republic, his parents and brother Dalibor, have all passed away. I have been in Canada for almost 30 years. You have 30 years of memories here. And I need to pause to remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And the next article is under the byline of City Hall. Council veteran Fletcher to retire. Chow allies surprise move creates open race in downtown ward. And this is by David Ryder. In a shock move, Toronto Danforth Councillor Paula Fletcher, revealed Wednesday that she had scrapped plans for re-election and instead will retire after 23 years at City Hall. The development jolted a Toronto civic election already roiling from late big-name entries into council races. Fletcher, 75, told the Star that she made the decision Wednesday morning after paddleboarding on Lake Ontario, only 2 days after she had registered to run in the October 26 election for a sixth term. I feel like, okay, I've given it my all, and now I can take a break, the progressive ally of Mayor Olivia Chow said, after listing several ongoing projects that she feels are well enough along that she can leave them to a successor. Fletcher released a farewell letter to her constituents and City Hall colleagues, outlining her surprise change of heart. While I looked out over our beautiful city in the morning light, I thought long and hard about the last 23 years and the great privilege I've had to serve the many communities in Toronto, Danforth, Fletcher wrote. She said she thought about the decades of work to bring back the Don River, resulting in the spectacular new Bittesidge Park, as well as late former colleagues Pam McConnell and Jack Layton, and her final 3 years working with Chow. There, out on the water, I felt a great sense of calm and made a big decision. I decided to remove my name from the ballot and not seek re-election, she wrote. Today, I am announcing my retirement from City Hall. As well as Bidosage, a massive flood-proofing project and new island community, Fletcher cited completed work on a new housing project at Danforth and Greenwood Avenues and her work with Metrolinx to smooth Ontario line issues. It's time to pass the torch to the next generation, Fletcher concluded. It's time for a new chapter for our community and for me. Fletcher said many people have told her they'll run if she doesn't, but she did not name a preferred successor. As of Wednesday, four other candidates were registered in Toronto Danforth. Susan Chappelle, Dennis Corcoran, Jason Stevens, and Denise Walcott. The timing gives other hopefuls only 2 days to jump into the race. Nominations close at 2 p.m. Friday. In a statement, Chow, who is seeking re-election, thanked Fletcher for her tremendous contribution to Toronto, calling her a champion of waterfront revitalization, film industry development, and climate actions as chair of the Infrastructure and Environment Committee. She was a dedicated servant for her community and our city, Chow wrote. I wish her a happy retirement. Asked what she plans to do with her time, Fletcher pointed to the farewell letter photo of her paddleboarding and said, it's time to take it easy a bit. However, she vowed to continue being active in the ward and to help out her successor in whatever way possible. Originally from Sainte-Marie, Fletcher first got into politics in Winnipeg, serving as leader of the Communist Party of Canada in the early 1980s. In Toronto, she parlayed leadership of the East End Parent Network into election as a Toronto District School Board trustee in 2000. 3 years later, Fletcher succeeded Jack Layton as counselor for the former Ward 30, which, after the 2018 election, expanded and became Ward 14. At City Hall, Fletcher is known as a shrewd, pragmatic, progressive, able to advance projects under successive mayors. During Rob Ford's chaotic 2010-2014 mayoral tenure, she led the fight against plans to scrap long-developed waterfront rejuvenation plans in favor of a glitzy version with a Ferris wheel, mega mall, and boat-in hotel. Her departure creates an open ward alongside Beaches, East York, where incumbent Councillor Brad Bradford is running for mayor. Candidates including former Liberal MP Nate Erskine-Smith, CTV journalist Natalie Johnson, and former city employee James Dan are vying to replace Bradford. Parkdale High Park is also open with the retirement of Gord Perks, another longtime progressive councillor. Earlier this week, Mike Layton, who left City Hall in 2022 after 12 years as councillor, registered to run in University Rosedale, setting up a battle with one-term incumbent Diane Sachs. The next article is from, it's under a byline called The Netherlands. Mystery man may be from Ontario. Dutch authorities now investigating whether Lucky could be person who went missing in 1994. This is by Mark Coley. He's living in a nursing home in the Netherlands. He has no known family or friends, nor a bank card or ID. And ever since he collapsed on the streets of Amsterdam in 2023, he has been unable to speak or communicate. As best as Dutch police can tell, he goes by Lucky. They want to know who he is. After 3 years of fruitless investigations, Netherlands police this week began sharing the unidentified man's story. In just 2 days, they've received more than 500 tips from the public. The most promising? He may be an Ontario man who went missing more than three decades ago. Lucky, as he has come to be known, collapsed on May 10, 2023. He suffered a brain hemorrhage or stroke, doctors determined, and had aphasia, the inability to speak or communicate. He now struggles to say much more than nonsense and definitely. An investigation by Amsterdam police to determine his identity came up empty. Since then, retired investigators Ruud Schoonmaker and Nell Shep have taken over. Working now as volunteers, they have mapped out what they can of Lucky's social circles. Schoonmaker and Shep know he was a member of a Buddhist community in Amsterdam, where he went by Lucky. They know he occasionally had a drink at a restaurant called Soap en Zoo, where he was known as Chris the Canadian. A worker there told Dutch News he frequented the restaurant, always carrying a suitcase and asking for very particular variations of soup. He looked shabby, but always had money. He also went by Louis, Lee, John, Ponytail, and Sonny. He spoke English with a North American accent. Lucky was a well-known figure in the Waterloopplein area, Schoonmaker and Shep found, where he frequented shops and market stalls. He was said to be extremely wealthy, but was also seen wandering the streets. Schoenmaker and Shep believe he has a past in North America or Nepal. The goal is to find out who he is, but also to find out if there are any relatives out there. Marietke Stoor, a spokesperson for Amsterdam Police, told the Star, "Most of the day he spends by himself. We hope to maybe find someone who could make his day a little brighter." The investigation has struck a chord in the Netherlands, where Lucky has become a major news story. For Deborah Barrode, who frequents the Waterloopline area and interviews strangers for her Humans of Amsterdam social media account, it hits close to home. He feels like a familiar face, even though they've never met. Just the fact that someone isn't able to even identify themselves, she told the Star, it's really sad. Of the more than 500 tips police have received in just 2 days, many are what the Dutch call meeting tips, Stoor said, brainstorming aspects of the investigation not yet explored. "Have you done a DNA test?" "Of course," Stoor said. "Have you asked if people know where he grew up?" "Yes, they have. In the end, only some tips have required investigating. One has stood out. It's of a man named John Russell. Kenny. Originally from Ontario, Kenny lived without an address in Vancouver and suffered from mental health issues, according to Vancouver police. He went missing in May 1994. He was 34. Both Kenny and Lucky have grayish eyes and unkempt hair. "The pictures do look alike," said Stoor. "That is something we are now investigating." Megan Liu, a spokesperson for the Vancouver police, confirmed the missing person unit is actively collaborating with Netherlands police and Interpol to determine if Kenny and Lucky are the same person. "The investigation remains ongoing," Liu wrote in an email. "If a positive identification is made, we will provide an update as soon as appropriate." Stoor emphasized the investigation is far from finished. "We really want to urge people not to make sudden assumptions," she said. "Just a similar-looking photo is not enough to identify someone, and we do not want to give families of missing people false hope. Until then, the search for Lucky continues." And I need to pause once more to remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next article is titled, "Man Faces Charges for Allegedly Firing Gun to Stop Car Thieves." And this is by Joshua Smith. A Scarborough resident has been charged after police allege he fired a gun as suspected thieves attempted to steal a vehicle from a driveway early Wednesday morning. Officers responded to a call for a suspicious incident in the area near Kingston Road and McCowan Road shortly after 2:30 a.m., they said, on social media later that morning. Multiple unidentified people were trying to steal a vehicle from the driveway of a home before the resident of the home fired a gun, police added. No injuries were reported, investigators said, while noting that a nearby home was damaged by the gunfire. Those suspects fled the scene before officers arrived, police added. The suspects that fled weren't able to steal the resident's vehicle. Toronto Police spokesperson Stephanie Maselli said in an email. The resident of the home, a 37-year-old man from Toronto, was charged with recklessly discharging a firearm, Maselli said. He was scheduled to appear in Toronto bail court on Wednesday, she said. The investigation is ongoing, and police are asking anyone with information to call them at 416-808-4300. The charges laid in this case are once again giving rise to the question of self-defense allowances in Canada. Under Canadian law, people do have the right to defend themselves and their property, but only within reason. There are several factors the courts consider when determining what is reasonable, which includes things like the nature of the threat, whether there were other means to respond to it, whether someone used or threatened to use a weapon, and the size, age, and gender of the people involved. The next article is titled, She is Our Hero. Ontario family's dog stepped in after a bear barged into their home. And there is a picture of Chloe, a 7-year-old mixed breed dog, and she's being honored by pet food company Purina's Animal Hall of Fame for protecting her owners from a black bear attack last fall in Nipigon, Ontario. And this is by Joshua Smith. They say not all heroes wear capes. As it turns out, some have fur. Chloe, a 7-year-old dog in Nipigon, Ontario, about a 90-minute drive northeast of Thunder Bay, is being honored by pet food company Purina's Animal Hall of Fame for protecting her owners from a black bear attack last fall. A bear barged into the home of Colette and Joe Schwetz on September 16, 2025, according to the Purina website. Colette let Chloe, a rescued mixed breed who is part black mouth cur, out at about 11 p.m. that night, as she typically did before bedtime. After walking down the deck stairs, they came upon a bear that was hiding behind the railing. Chloe quickly ran back up the stairs, but the bear followed her. Schwetz got Chloe inside and tried to shut the door, but the bear got in too. The next thing I remember, the 300-pound bear is on top of me, Schwetz said, according to the website. I remember screaming, help me, please, someone help me. The bear started attacking Schwetz, biting and scratching her, she recalled. In that moment, she saw her life flash before her eyes. The website reads, Chloe was able to wake up Colette's sleeping husband, Joe, who wears a loud CPAP machine. The bear turned its attention to Joe when he got involved, but Chloe then jumped into action, helping her owners push the bear into the basement. Despite being injured in the attack, Joe was able to call 911 while Chloe ensured the bear stayed in the basement. According to police, every time the bear would try to come up, Chloe would go after it, going partially down the stairs and barking at it, Colette said. The bear was scared of her. Officers arrived and safely put an end to the incident, the website notes. Chloe did everything in her power to keep her owners safe from the bear, according to the website. The dog suffered serious bite and scratch wounds and required multiple stitches, much like her owners. She is our hero, Colette said. Every year, Purina invites animal owners to submit stories of heroism, and they receive dozens of entries from across the country, company spokesperson Malie A. Sheik said. Colette Schwetz submitted Chloe's story this year. The next story is titled, Scrap Bargaining System Teachers Union Urges. Splitting talks between province and boards is failing. This is by Kristen Rishoi. The current bargaining system, The current bargaining system in education isn't working and needs to be scrapped, says the head of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation. Martha Hradoi told a meeting of about 300 of her union's leaders Wednesday afternoon that reforms introduced more than a decade ago by the previous Liberal government, creating both a provincial level of bargaining on major issues and local talks for more administrative matters, have become too centralized. Right now, the biggest obstacle isn't disagreement over major bargaining priorities. We haven't even been able to get there, she said. In our school board sector, before meaningful bargaining can proceed, the parties have to determine which issues will be negotiated centrally and which will be negotiated locally. And for 2 of 3 rounds of bargaining with this government, we've been unable to reach agreement on it. The Ford government, she added, continues to push more bargaining to the central table and shrink the space for local bargaining. In this round, they are taking that even further, while still supporting talks with the province on major funding issues. "We don't see an opportunity to amend or fix the act," she later told reporters. "We need to start from scratch." The Bargaining Act has undergone some changes since 2014, and earlier this year, the Ford government made some further legislative changes, removing trustee associations and instead putting the Council of Ontario Directors of Education at the negotiating table. Under the Act, central talks cover costly items such as salary, benefits, and some working conditions, given the province holds the purse strings. That leaves non-monetary items to be hammered out between union locals and individual school boards. Hradoi said the province is now seeking to handle sick day notes, staff transfers, and layoff/redundancy issues, among other matters, when they should be left to local talks. Most of the education unions have appealed to the Labor Board to rule on the central/local questions, which has left the current round of talks in limbo for now. The Star did not receive a comment from Education Minister Paul Calandra's office about Hradoi's remarks, but regarding the delay, he has said that at this early stage of bargaining, the first step is to determine what issues will be negotiated at central or local tables. Those decisions are still underway, with some unions choosing to bring this matter to the Ontario Labor Relations Board. "We respect their decision to do so, and at all times are ready to continue discussions on the scope of central versus local issues before proceeding to the next stage of negotiations." The next article is titled Missing Oshawa Pilot Found Dead in Kawarthas. Home-built plane was submerged in Wolf Lake. And this is by Joshua Smith. The pilot of a home-built plane who had been missing since late last week has been found. Search crews found a home-built plane submerged in Wolf Lake on Tuesday and confirmed that the body of the 73-year-old pilot was found following an extensive multi-agency search effort in the city of Kawartha Lakes, the OPP said Wednesday in a news release. The pilot, who was previously identified by his family as David Douglas, was reported missing after he didn't return to Oshawa Executive Airport on Friday morning as scheduled. Durham police said that day that he departed the airport at 8:30 a.m. in a single-seat, home-built, blue and yellow aircraft with the letters FOFZ on the tail. They believed he was heading into Kawartha Lakes area. He was expected to return to Oshawa at about 9:30 a.m., but failed to do so, investigators said. Durham police were investigating the missing person case while the Joint Rescue Coordination Center asked for assistance from the OPP to track down the plane, which police said had been flying in the Balsam Lake area near Kirkfield, Ontario. Several other crews ultimately joined the search, including the Underwater Search and Recovery Unit, Aviation Services, the OPP said Wednesday. Those rescue crews found debris from the plane in Wolf Lake on Sunday, but Douglas was still missing. They found the plane submerged in the lake 2 days later and confirmed Douglas died, according to the OPP, which added that investigators are working on an extraction plan. The Transportation Safety Board of Canada is now probing the circumstances of the crash, provincial police said. Douglas worked in maintenance at Corporate Aircraft Restorations, a company at the Oshawa Executive Airport. The company declined to comment to the Star on Tuesday, citing the ongoing search. The pilot spent his time taking aircraft apart, refurbishing them, and putting them back together in new condition, according to Chris McDade, who works at the airport in New Douglas. "He was very competent in that way," said McDade, who spoke to the Star on Tuesday. "Dave didn't skimp on stuff. He was top-notch in his field." Douglas was soft-spoken and kept to himself, but was well-known at the airport, which he had spent time at since at least the 1990s, according to McDade. Douglas enjoyed low-level flights and shooting video over the Kawartha Lakes region. Whenever he landed, he wiped his plane down and brought it back to the hangar. "It was his baby," explained McDade, a sales rep at Aviation Unlimited. "It's your home airport. It's his home. It hits home," McDade said as the search was ongoing. "Everybody feels it. Aviation is a very tight community." And I need to remind you one more time that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next article is titled CTV's The Social to Become Video Podcast. Co-host Graylo also leaving as talk show makes changes. This is by David Friend. CTV's long-standing daytime talk show The Social is making big changes ahead of its 14th season that will have it looking very different. Bell Media announced Wednesday that it will reimagine the series. That means there will be no more studio audience. Founding co-host Melissa Graylo will be leaving, and the talk show will be relaunching as a video podcast that will also continue to air on broadcast television. Bell says Graylo is leaving to focus on her health podcast, Aging Powerfully, with Melissa Graylo. The significant changes come before the start of the new season on September 9. Representatives for Bell Media did not immediately respond to requests for comment, but its announcement noted that the show would continue to film on its existing Toronto set at the broadcaster's headquarters on Queen Street. On Queen Street West. The reimagined version will broadcast on CTV and be made available on Crave, iHeartRadio, Canada Platforms, and The Social YouTube channel. Graylo posted a message on her Instagram account saying that after 13 seasons on The Social and 18 years at Bell Media, it is time to move on. She called the show one of the great privileges of my career. But I've also always believed that the world around you is changing, you can either hold on tightly to what has been or get curious about what comes next, she wrote. The way we create, consume, and connect through media is changing dramatically. I am enormously grateful to the network for saying yes to my idea all those years ago and for working with me to build what social media has become. The Social began airing in 2013 as Canada's answer to The View and The Talk, two popular female-led lifestyle shows that tackled the hot topics of the day. In recent years, its daily program has been repurposed to be shared on social media and distributed through streaming platform Crave. Some of its original co-hosts have also departed the program over the years, including Lainey Liu and Tracy Melchor. With Graylo's departure, only Cynthia Loist remains from the original four. She will continue to host the program alongside Jess Allen and Andrea Bain, who will take hosting duties on the revival of Big Brother Canada, which begins on CTV next summer. Bell Media has been growing its selection of video podcasts, part of a wider industry trend led by the popularity of the format on YouTube and the recent entry of Netflix into the space. Crave began rolling out nearly a dozen podcasts to the service this year, including editions of Rush Hour Sports Radio Show Overdrive, gay Canadian pop culture series Bestie Listen, and a weekly best of edition of its Your Morning Show. All of the shows were already available on YouTube. The social was already on the platform in its full video format. As the reach and influence of video podcasts grows globally, this evolution was the natural step for the social, allowing the series to expand and reach Canadian and international audiences on the platform of their choice, said executive producer Laura Scarfo in a release. Okay, I'm having a little technical difficulty here, so I can only read articles on the bottom half of the page. So the next one is titled, Poll shows most Canadians back U.S. booze ban, but many support lifting it if it helps secure a trade deal. This is by Robert Benzie. 4 out of 5 Canadians back the prohibition of U.S. alcohol sales in retaliation for President Donald Trump's tariffs, a new poll suggests. The Polaris Strategic Insights Survey also found 42% of respondents would boycott American wine and spirits if they returned to provincial liquor stores. Still, 54% would support lifting the ban if it helps Prime Minister Mark Carney secure a trade deal with Trump. In every province, it's basically 80% support, Dan Arnold, Polaris Chief Strategy Officer, said in an interview Wednesday. 8 provinces, including Ontario, 79% support for the ban, Quebec, 81%, and British Columbia, 80%, have removed Kentucky bourbon, California wines, and other products from store shelves in response to Trump imposing levies on some Canadian goods. Canada's booze ban has been a major sticking point with Washington in the ongoing negotiations to end the trade dispute and remains hugely popular here. Even in the provinces that haven't banned alcohol, you've got 2/3 who would say they should have, he said, pointing to 67% support for a U.S. prohibition in Alberta and 63% in Saskatchewan. So that shows that it's something that is cross-partisan, cross-demographic. It unites both heavy drinkers and non-drinkers, too. Only 15% of respondents oppose the measures. Polaris surveyed 1,833 Canadian citizens August 10 through 13, using respondents recruited from a mix of the Ledger and Dynata online research panels. While online panel samples cannot be assigned a margin of error, for comparison purposes, a random sample of this size would have 1 of ±2.3 percentage points, 19 times out of 20. A majority of 54% said if Carney agreed to lift the ban on sales of U.S. alcohol across Canada in exchange for President Trump lifting some tariffs, but not all tariffs on Canadian goods, they would support this deal. 1/3, 33%, said they would oppose it, and 13% weren't sure, while 42% said they would continue to boycott U.S. booze, 14% said they would buy it less than I used to, and 26% said they never bought it before or don't drink alcohol, while only 12% said they would purchase as much as I used to. In some respects, Canada may be negotiating away something that is irrelevant at the end of the day, said Arnold. It may be sitting on shelves and no one is buying it. So in that respect, when it comes to the trade-off situation, people are probably fine with it. Overall, 59% of respondents approved of Carney's handling of Canada-U.S. relations, and 32% disapproved, with 61% saying he is managing Donald Trump about it as well as anyone could. But 50% say the Prime Minister has been elbows up when dealing with the current president, and 49% say Carney has made too many concessions to Trump. Similarly, 51% backed Carney's compromise to get the Canadian-built Gordie Howe International Bridge opened last month between Windsor and Detroit, while 38% disapproved of the estimated $320 million in payouts to the U.S. over 15 years. The remainder were unsure. Canadians trust Carney, but they are not giving him a blank check of trust, said Arnold. Finally, Trump's popularity in Canada has plunged to a historic low, with only 9% of respondents having positive feelings toward the president and 80% feeling negative about him. A majority of 52% said they were angry with him, and 28% said frustrated, while 7% were comfortable with Trump and 2% excited, while 10% had no view at all. And I'm going to end with, you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 20 issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Jane. Thank you for listening.